Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents NASA and the Long Civil Rights Movement. Edited by Brian C. Odom and Stephen P. Waring. Narrated by Diana Blue. Publisher's note: in this audio edition, you will hear references to figures present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Forward. How we tell about the civil rights movement and why it matters. Jacqueline Dowd Hall. Few public figures today would dream of denying that the civil rights movement was a good thing, but plenty would implicitly or explicitly posit a sharp break between the good civil rights movement, which overcame real evils in the distant past, and current campaigns such as Black Lives Matter or the Moral Monday movement in North Carolina. That invidious distinction between then and now rests on a sanitized Montgomery to Memphis narrative about a short, triumphant Southern civil rights movement led by a few individuals who relied on restrained, dignified strategies and pursued limited goals. In this version of the past, the movement started with the Montgomery bus boycott of 1955, came to a climax with the passage of the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts, and ended with Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination in 1968. Its primary aim was to overturn the South's explicitly race-based segregation and disenfranchisement laws, and it stood in sharp contrast to both Black power and Northern struggles. In a presidential address I delivered to the Organization of American Historians in 2004, and an article titled "The Long Civil Rights Movement and the Political Uses of the Past," I published the next year, I tried to embed the heroic struggles of the 1950s and 1960s in the context of what I had come to understand as a longer, broader, deeper narrative. I pointed to the modern civil rights era's beginnings in the late 1930s and early 1940s. This was the period in which African American activism, which took place primarily on the local level, became national in scope. The collapse of the South's sharecropping system, Black migration to the cities, the emergence of a strong federal government, critical legal victories on the part of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP, the example of anti-colonial uprisings, the opportunities offered to Black workers by an insurgent labor movement, the efforts of Blacks and whites on the left edge of the New Deal coalition to build an egalitarian welfare state and put racial equality on the national political agenda. All these enabled local civil rights struggles to unfold in a vastly transformed environment. Picking up on the work of Robert Korstad, Nelson Lichtenstein, and others, I suggested that the Cold War and McCarthyism rolled back the unions and stigmatized the left, helping to rout the civil rights movement into new channels and erasing the Black activists who pursued what Korstad called civil rights unionism from popular memory. I characterized the upheavals of the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s as a movement of movements, rather than a series of mutually exclusive battles. I tried to direct attention to the struggles for access to schools and jobs that continued, and in some cases, intensified, after the fall of de jure segregation. Finally, drawing on a burgeoning new historiography of conservatism, I underscored the point that the long civil rights movement flowed in parallel with a long conservative movement that metamorphosed over time as it resisted and, at critical moments, thwarted civil rights gains. By considering the progressive and conservative movements of the mid-20th century in tandem, I came to see that the story of a short, successful civil rights movement has persisted in part because it served the goals of those who, like the architects of the recent wave of voter suppression laws, want to wrap themselves in the mantle of the movement, even as they undo many of its gains. Conservatives in the 1930s and 1940s opposed the expansion of the New Deal and fought tooth and nail against advocates of unionization and black civil rights. In the 1970s, however, they reinvented themselves as the guardians of colorblind laws, which they took to be the civil rights movement's singular goal. Since that goal has been attained, they suggest individual African Americans bear the onus of their own failure or success. If stark group inequalities persist, whether in wealth or political power or treatment by the criminal justice system, then blacks' attitudes, behavior, and family structures are to blame. Therefore, the thinking goes, we do not need to group remedies such as public employees' unions to protect workers in the sectors where minorities and women have made the most progress, or color and class-conscious policies aimed at creating integrated schools, or affirmative efforts to open educational and employment opportunities to traditionally excluded groups, or the oversight mandated by the Voting Rights Act. When I began writing about these matters 15 years ago, I had the exciting sense of having my finger on the pulse of a vital scholarly trend. Since then, so many scholars in different fields and working on different periods and topics have augmented the long civil rights movement theme that an adequate accounting would require its own historiographical essay. NASA and the long civil rights movement offers yet another intriguing perspective on what has rightly been called America's original sin and on efforts to redeem our country from its foundations in slavery, segregation, and racial violence. Margot Lee Shetterly's Hidden Figures, along with the movie based on the book, brought welcome attention to the black women mathematicians at NASA, who, despite their treatment as second-class citizens, made heroic contributions to the space race that, in tandem with the civil rights and women's movements, so powerfully shaped mid-20th century American life. In Brian C. Odom and Stephen P. Waring's edited volume, we discover how, during this drive for aeronautical advancement, African Americans tried to turn the power of the federal government to their advantage, how white Southern segregationists simultaneously argued for states' rights and took advantage of federal largesse, and how the space program served as an agent of modernization and racial moderation, while at the same time displacing and excluding African Americans and promoting new, ostensibly gender and colorblind disparities. I have learned a tremendous amount from all of this new work. Among other things, I have had to think harder about the continuities and discontinuities between the New Deal generation and my own, which came to political consciousness in the 1960s. I originally stressed the degree to which McCarthyism silenced the black and white activists of the 1930s and 1940s, and thus narrowed the range of acceptable political discourse on which the civil rights movement could draw. My current work on that earlier generation, along with new research by others, has reinforced my conviction that it is vitally important to remember the damage that anti-communist hysteria did, and that similar forms of hysteria can still do. Yet, I am also persuaded by recent scholarship that I downplayed the links between the New Deal era and the later period, and so underestimated the continuity of, to take two examples, black left feminism and job-related struggles. And I take the point of those who advocate on a larger, broader, deeper narrative, but ground that narrative in studies of local organizing traditions in the rural South. A small group of scholars remains invested in drawing sharp distinctions between time periods, regions, strategies, and ideologies, especially between the social democratic activism of the 1930s and 1940s and that of the Montgomery to Memphis movement, between nonviolence and black power, and between the South and the North. I certainly understand these concerns. It is always important to account for differences and discontinuity, even as the passage of time and the accumulation of research allows us to make an even longer and broader view. I am even more sympathetic to the perspective articulated by Kevin Boyle, who wants to push beyond the traditional and long civil rights narratives to one centered on a long, slow slog of struggle against deeply entrenched social, economic, and political structures that, while diminished, have yet to give way. Still, I would stand by the value of the periodization I proposed, with the proviso that I see all periodization as a framework we impose in order to make sense of the messy reality of the past. And I am less interested in historians' quibbles about how to do that slicing and dicing than in what Jean Theo Harris terms the uses and misuses of the past. A recent encounter with a dedicated public school teacher reminded me, once again, of the urgency of our choices about which stories to tell and of how complicated popular memory can be. In response to a talk I gave at a seminar sponsored by the Southern Oral History Program at the University of North Carolina, Hugh Davis, a librarian and English teacher in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, reflected on the effect of bottling up the civil rights movement so that it covers just a few years with a few key figures and culminated in the passage of the Voting Rights Act. His students, virtually all of whom are Black, watch the news every day to see another story of an African American killed in the streets or subject to police brutality. Given that reality, they, unlike the white colorblind conservatives I wrote about, see the movement as a failure. To Hugh Davis, viewing the civil rights movement in a larger context produces hope that we might be in dark times, but that does not mean it will always stay that way. By reframing the movement in that way, I can discuss with my students the fact that times may be tough, but there are peaks and valleys of human behavior. The tough times they see are just part of a valley. That mountaintop, to co-opt Dr. King's metaphor, is still within sight. Countless efforts to reach that mountaintop are underway as we speak. Not least among them are books like this one, self-critical and aimed at strengthening key governmental institutions by confronting their past failures and their efforts to live up to their most lofty missions. Introduction. Exploring NASA in the Long Civil Rights Movement. Brian C. Odom. On July 15th, 1969, the Reverend Ralph Abernathy and members of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference's Poor People's Campaign gathered outside the gates of the Kennedy Space Center in protest of the vast sums diverted from social programs here on Earth to the technological marvel now pointed at the moon. To many Americans, the Apollo program represented the embodiment of the Enlightenment ideal of progress, an ideal grounded in the belief that all problems encountered in society were surmountable through the application of scientific principles. However, to the African American protesters standing alongside Abernathy and to many other critics across the country, Apollo represented a turning away from the plight of the poor and with it, the abandonment of previous gains of the civil rights movement. The intersection of the civil rights movement and the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, on that July day at Cape Canaveral, Florida, was neither the first nor the last. During the decade of the 1960s, NASA became something of a laboratory for social progress. Actions such as President John F. Kennedy's order for equal employment opportunity in March 1961 and the creation of cooperative education programs between NASA and several historically Black colleges and universities were representative of the concrete but limited engagement between the federal government and Black graduates in technical disciplines. With the Apollo program, Black graduates found the doors of economic opportunity gradually opening in many previously segregated occupations. White and Black women also saw an increase in opportunities for themselves in the previously white male-dominated fields of engineering and science. While the overall small increase in terms of numbers by the launch of Apollo 11 on July 16, 1969, left much to be desired, the pathways to new economic opportunity for Black graduates and for women were enshrined in law and visible within the public discourse. This collection of diverse essays is intended to promote a deeper, interdisciplinary exploration of the social history of NASA during the age of Apollo, developed around the ideas advocated by Jacqueline Dowd Hall in her 2005 essay, The Long Civil Rights Movement and the Political Uses of the Past. As a means of centralizing individual agency, Hall expanded the timeline of the civil rights movement and extended the scope to include the struggle for women's rights and labor. She also called upon historians to place their histories of the civil rights movement in the context of a longer story, a move that would make that history harder to simplify, appropriate, and contain. Recent additions to space historiography and filmography also reflect the growing interest in racial and social aspects of space history. Using Hall's framework, the contributing authors seek to provide a deeper degree of analysis so that other stories might emerge from the richer context. Applying this interdisciplinary approach to the experience of NASA during the Apollo program provided the authors an opportunity to recontextualize the experience of the space agency against the backdrop of social revolution, an economic transformation, and the growing Cold War with the Soviet Union. This approach reflects what former NASA chief historian Roger Launius described as the new aerospace history and is representative of other works from the NASA History Office, including The Societal Impact of Spaceflight. In his essay from that volume titled Space History from the Bottom Up, Glenn Asner echoes Hall's argument, noting that by bringing ordinary people and social groups into our analysis, historians could avoid reifying the concept of society and relegating masses of people to passive subjects of historical forces. Adjusting the view of the movement to the perspective of the Apollo program also offers new ways of thinking about both the impact of technology on society and the constraining environment offered in the Cold War context. The purpose of the following collection of essays is to address the role/relationship of NASA to the long civil rights movement, particularly, but not limited to, the Deep South, Huntsville, Alabama, Florida, Houston, Mississippi, and New Orleans, and to identify the impact of NASA on the movement and the experience of those who were directly affected by the space program, but also the impact of the movement on NASA's development in the period. The chapters in Part 1, New Frameworks, address the larger conceptual themes of NASA's relationship to the civil rights movement in an effort to expand beyond the largely white-focused, hagiographical narratives of the space program. In the first chapter, Margaret Weitekamp explores the state of the new aerospace history field. Here, Weitekamp offers a reevaluation of the state of the field in space history, looking especially at the influence of race, gender, and regional history. In response, Weitekamp suggests that attention should be paid to three major areas of growth in the field: individual and collective biography, fresh takes on technologies and cultural contexts, and international/global history. With the 50th anniversary of the first lunar landing in 2019, Weitekamp offers fresh thoughts on how historians should evaluate recent histories written since the last major reexamination in 2007, when it was occasioned by the 50th anniversary of the birth of the space age. In Chapter 2, P.J. Blunt and David Molina trace NASA's attempted counter-narrative of social value and a policy of liberal equality rooted in the concept of all mankind. They consider whether this argument for NASA's value remains a salient one at present, as the continued inequalities of American life are increasingly highlighted in the media, and as we face a historical moment in which activists and astronauts alike will be challenged to bridge the distance between Black Lives Matter and Mars. In Chapter 3, Molina and Blunt offer a contextualization of NASA's interlocutory role throughout the long civil rights movement by mobilizing these three themes to analyze a series of archival and cultural artifacts. The authors first analyze the rhetoric deployed by the Poor People Campaign's various mobilizations to show that the American space program was viewed with deep skepticism by the African American community, and particularly within the context of ongoing struggles for Black freedom. Second, they discuss the distance between the tropes of spatial disenfranchisement represented in the civil rights movement and the moon missions, to prove how space exploration was portrayed as an acceleration of the marginalization of Black spaces. The three chapters that make up Part 2, Southern Context, explore the experience of the space agency in the Jim Crow South. Brenda Plummer examines the effect of the U.S. space program on race relations in key areas of the South and the impact of that connection on popular culture. She also explores the intersection of the struggle for racial equality and aerospace exploration, as both constituted potent narratives of freedom in the American imaginary. Plummer disputes the assumption that NASA, as an instrument of modernization, was implicitly allied with the civil rights movement. While the transformation of parts of the Deep South undeniably broke up earlier political, economic, and cultural patterns, aerospace research and development helped inaugurate a successor regime that neither challenged the structural foundations of racial inequality nor guarded against the production of new disparities. Matthew L. Downs explores the impact of Sunbelt era federal development and the response of civic and commercial leaders to the civil rights movement, demonstrating how local leaders worked closely with government officials to attract and maintain such installations and the accompanying public and private investment. When federal officials and their representatives in Huntsville made clear that Southern intransigence on civil rights would adversely affect the local, space-based economy, the city's civic leaders modulated their approach to civil rights in the hopes of ensuring continued support. Such action was particularly surprising given the overtly hostile response to the movement by Alabama's other local leaders and the state government. While Huntsville was not without conflict, the presence of the federal government combined with the threat that Southern resistance might lead to a withdrawal of federal support led the city to a more moderate reaction when the city's local movement pressured for equality. In Chapter 6, Brian Odom surveys the implementation of equal employment opportunity at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville. Odom contends that Marshall's strategy focused on recruiting qualified African-American engineering students outside of Alabama and developing a partnership with the Association of Huntsville Area Contractors, AHAC, locally. By serving both as a catalyst for technical educational programs in the Huntsville community and as a clearinghouse for job opportunities and racial dialogue, AHAC facilitated a modicum of progress toward minority gains. During the civil rights movement, local activists such as Dr. Sonny Hereford III and aerospace executives such as Brown Engineering Company's Milton K. Cummings brokered backroom agreements meant to improve Alabama's image problem while also expanding opportunities for Black graduates. Part 3, International Context, explores NASA and the civil rights movement in an international Cold War context. Kathleen Lewis argues that throughout the Cold War, race played an important role in foreign policy, with the United States painfully aware that its civil rights situation could have an adverse impact on foreign policy ambitions abroad. The USSR preyed on that U.S. sensitivity, calling the country out on its failures. In the early 1980s, almost a decade after U.S. foreign policy had all but abandoned race as a Cold War issue, the race issue reemerged, albeit briefly, when the USSR launched the first black man into space. The mission had two benefits for the USSR. First, it was retaliation against the United States for boycotting the 1980 Moscow Olympics. Second, it preempted the launch of the first American black astronaut. This final battle over race in the Cold War ultimately revealed American domestic progress and the hollowness of Soviet space stunts. Keith Snediger explores the impact of the civil rights movement on decisions related to NASA facilities outside the United States. Snediger maintains that when Charles C. Diggs Jr., one of the founders of the Congressional Black Caucus, visited the NASA satellite tracking station at Hartebeestok, South Africa, in 1971, he discovered a racially segregated facility where technical jobs were reserved for white employees and black Africans essentially performed menial labor. Upon his return to the United States, the Detroit congressman embarked on a 2-year struggle, first to improve workplace equity at the tracking station, and later for the closure of the facility. NASA administration under James Fletcher was largely indifferent to demands for change at the station. It was only after Representative Charles Rangel proposed a reduction in NASA appropriations that the agency announced plans to end its working relationship with the white minority regime of South Africa. NASA's public statements suggested that a scientific rationale lay behind the station's eventual closure in 1975, but this episode clearly indicates that NASA was acting only under political pressure, and its management remained largely insensitive to global issues of racial equality. The fourth set of essays addressed larger issues of race, gender, and the utilization of NASA technology on Earth. In Chapter 9, Cyrus Modi argues that NASA and the Johnson Space Center experienced the 1970s through the paradox of existential success. The Apollo program convinced other organizations that NASA engineers had a competence which should be used, and therefore hired those engineers away and or tapped NASA's expertise for their own organizational objectives. Meanwhile, the gap between Apollo and the shuttle meant NASA had reasons to accede to such demands, and few political resources to resist them. As a result, the possibility emerged, if briefly, for NASA to reorient its mission to the issues given currency by the civil rights movement. Poverty, especially among ethnic minority communities, environmental justice, the urban dysfunctions created by white flight to the suburbs, and so forth. That possibility soon disappeared, though, says much about the changing politics of race and civil rights in the 1980s and beyond. Eric Fenrick studies the efforts of black activists and NASA to increase minority educational access that would lead to greater participation in the space program. According to Fenrick, the concurrence of the civil rights movement and the American space program reveals the two primary methods by which the advocates in the modern era have sought to advance the interests of African Americans. First, a negative project. The removal of formal barriers to the exercise of rights, more specifically, ending discriminatory practices in employment and education. Second, more positive efforts, such as equal employment opportunities and affirmative action, that place opportunities within the reach of historically disadvantaged people. In Chapter 11, Christina Roberts explores the perception that NASA performed poorly in hiring women during the long civil rights era, arguing that that perception is based on low recruitment numbers by comparison with many other federal agencies. Others blame NASA's poor recruitment.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?